Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 25th of January. This guest was featured on 60 Minutes a few weeks ago, and her work is so extraordinarily interesting. We're happy to have her with us this hour. Dr. Betty Dresser is Senior Vice President of Research and Facility Director for the Audubon Center for Research of Endangered Species. It's located on 1,200 acres from close to downtown New Orleans. The facilities opened in 1996, and they have a very large staff now. The center has been globally recognized for work with in vitro fertilization, cryopreservation, embryo transfer for wildlife conservation using species such as bongo antelope, gorillas, and exotic cats. And she is working to establish international research programs that will take the center's science from the lab to the field. The idea for all of this, of course, is to safeguard endangered animals for future generations and to preserve the Earth's genetic heritage. We're going to be welcoming phone calls for Dr. Dresser. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hello, Dr. Dresser. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hello, Kathleen. Yeah. You're very welcome.
Happy days in New Orleans today, huh?
Yeah, the city's celebrating.
Yeah. You went to the game?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, great. Yeah, it was quite a game. And it was so symbolic, wasn't it, to think about what that stadium had been through, what the city had been through, and the first time in history for the team. We're not talking about that, but as long as you were there, it must have been quite a night.
It's a wonderful celebration, I can tell you.
Yeah.
Many, many happy people here today.
Yeah, well, I am sure. All right, let's talk about when you decided that you were going to do something quite extraordinary to make sure that the Earth's genetic heritage was preserved.
Well, I guess it was when I was in college, and I had grown up at the zoo in Cincinnati, and, you know, the handwriting was on the wall. I mean, we, as the most dominant species, as humans, have to do something to save wildlife, and, you know, we're really stewards of wildlife, and so I think, you know, I realized at that time that there was going to have to be a lot of answers to this whole wildlife extinction issue. And so we started developing technology, or thinking about at least, you know, ideas for technology that we could use as kind of a safety net for wildlife. And that's kind of how we've advanced, just looking at all possible reproductive technologies that we could use.
And you've gone ahead and used them, too.
Yes, we have. You know, as we develop them, we like to prove them. You know, because developing these technologies is expensive, we try to produce, you know, a number of offspring, and then realize that maybe other scientists can take the work and advance it, or we have it kind of in our safety net, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about specifically the work that you're doing. You're freezing sperm, embryos, tissues of endangered species. You're doing experimentation with in vitro fertilization for hard-to-breed animals. You're transferring embryos from one species to another. You're really at the cutting edge here.
Yeah, I think we are. Those are all the kinds of technologies, you know, we're developing. And we follow a little bit on the coattails of what's developed with domestic animals. We've also recently been involved with some cloning work or nuclear transfer, as well as now we're looking at some stem cell work. Because seriously, animals are going extinct so quickly today, and so we just need some kind of, like I said before, safety net that we can fall back on if indeed the habitat isn't there for those animals to live in.
Mm-hmm. What's going extinct?
Oh, many, many species of you know, I mean, everything from the charismatic giant pandas all the way down to little frogs, or many, many birds. There's just a whole long list of species that are going extinct.
Mm-hmm. And it's your mission, and add to this however you'd like, is to make sure that the world will always be able to have these animals that are now endangered, to say nothing of the animals that will become endangered.
Absolutely. I mean, do you want your kids, you know, to see elephants and rhinos in just textbooks? I mean, you know, that's how we see dinosaurs or, you know, woolly mammoth animals that used to walk this planet. And, you know, I don't want to see them in books. I want to see them. I want to, you know, live amongst them and hear them and smell them and, you know, just exist with them. I mean, I think our quality of life as humans depends on other life on this planet. And I just wouldn't want to be the only species here.
Mm-hmm. So how have you decided? Is it in terms of the most endangered, the animals that you choose to use interspecies mating, or the animals that you are working on perhaps cloning? What's the priority here?
Well, quite honestly, a lot of it depends on really two things. One is funding, the money to be able to work with these species, and the other is the availability of the animals. I mean, often, you know, species are endangered because they're so low in number, and sometimes there's not enough animals to work with to be able to even develop some of the technology. So that's why sometimes we use model animals, like the domestic cat, for example, for some of these small endangered cats. Or we might use a common antelope for, you know, as a model for some of these rare antelope. And then if we can use those common ones as surrogate mothers for some of these embryos that we transfer to produce a larger number of offspring, that's what we try to do.
And how do you know what's going to work?
Well, a lot of times it's trial and error. Sometimes we don't know. You know, you have to have similar size, especially of the babies that are born. You have to have a similar length of pregnancy. There's a lot of different factors that enter in as we make our choices. But if you don't have the funding either to do it, I mean, you just can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because the science is expensive. So there's a lot of factors that are involved. And also, we work nationally and internationally, you know, to keep up with what kinds of animals might need our help. I've been on the board of the Association of Zoos and Aquariums a number of times, and we all try to work together amongst the zoos and aquariums to determine what, you know, what's the most crucial, what's the most important.
So how are zoos helping you? Do you use animals from zoos sometimes, or?
Yes, we do, and also we work with scientists from other zoos and aquariums. You know, everybody kind of working together is what, you know, what helps not only in the funding, but it's kind of a brain trust, so that you're not duplicating what somebody else is doing. So you know, it's really a collaborative kind of project.
You were able to do the world's first test tube gorilla, is that right?
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
and interestingly enough, that was working with different obstetrics and gynecology departments at universities, because they were really kind of advanced with some of the equipment and techniques for humans. And so we were able to apply some of that to working with gorillas. So in that case, it went the other way. You know, it was humans helping the animals.
Uh-huh. And once these animals are born, where do they go?
Well, they may, some animals that we work with, we release back into areas if they're releasable and there's areas for them to go to, or they may go to other zoos and aquariums.
And what about zoos' missions now? I know it's changed. Give me the history of this. Zoos' missions to preserve endangered species. Do most zoos feel that that's what they're all about now?
Very much so. I mean, you know, back in history, I mean, zoos were kind of menageries. You know, they were animals collected for the pleasure of kings and queens and then for the public. And today, you know, we don't have that any longer, really. Most every zoo and aquarium, if they're accredited through the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, they're working on conservation. They're working to help animals that they have in captivity, as well as they're putting a lot of money into field projects, you know, other countries where they can help animals that are actually in their, you know, original habitats.
Mm-hmm.
So they're doing a lot, really. I think zoos and aquariums have really stepped up to the plate. And when you go there and you spend your money to go to the zoo and aquarium, there's a certain percentage of that gate cost that goes back into conserving these animals.
Tell me more about cryopreservation, Dr. Dresser. What exactly is that?
Sure. It's a fancy word, really, for freezing, if you will. what it allows us to do, and it really started in the cattle industry years ago, and what it allows us to do is to kind of put on hold, if you will, a living cell. And that can be a sperm or an egg or an embryo. And now with cloning coming on, you know, we can just take a skin sample and preserve those cells. And what we do is we remove the cellular water from these cells to keep them from freezing too quickly and just bursting, really. We put what's like an antifreeze, it's called a cryoprotectant, in it. And once you do that and you lower the temperature on these cells, you put them in liquid nitrogen, and essentially they're alive, but they just sit there. And we think that we can keep these cells for hundreds, maybe thousands of years. And really what you've done is you've frozen the DNA. The DNA now we have on many, many animals, individuals, different species, every animal really that we get our hands on, we take a skin sample now, or we take a sperm sample or whatever, and we freeze it and we keep it in what we call our frozen zoo.
Oh, my goodness. and then eventually what would be done with those?
Well, you know, we don't know what the science of the future is going to be or what the scientists in the future will be, but what we do know is these cells are alive. And had we had cells, let's say, you know, everybody's always asking about dinosaurs or woolly mammoths or Tasmanian devils or all those animals, we don't have live DNA from these species. But now in our frozen zoos, and there's a couple of them around the country and the world, we have these cells that are alive. So in the future, scientists way beyond my time really will probably, you know, have much, much, much more advanced technology that they can use this DNA for. It's almost like a blueprint or a template that we're giving them to say, hey, this is what made this animal up, and you know, you all have to use your own intelligence to know what to do with it.
Oh, my goodness. So with the logical extension of this, looking at human beings, because we all, of course, want to live forever, or at least some do. I'm not sure I do. Would the extension of this be you could get our DNA and put it in a little, you know, liquid nitrogen, and then we'll come back 1,000 years from now? I mean, really, could that happen?
Theoretically, I'll never say no to anything because I think, you know, it's anything's possible. Who knows? I just know that's not what we're doing with human work, because we don't want to see this planet just populated with humans. Right. You know, we believe the quality of life and the importance of all this wildlife really needs to remain on this planet.
And you talk about the possibility. Is this just way out there that we could survive, but we wouldn't have any other animals?
Oh yeah, or plants. Think about it. As our species grows and grows, I mean, we're taking over this planet. Now, will we live on other planets in the future? Who knows? You know, I guess again, you could say, well, this frozen material might, you know, be shipped to another planet. 100 years ago, we would have never guessed we were going to be on the moon. And look at it now. Look out 100 years. I'm actually writing a book now called Tigers to the Moon. And, you know, we don't know what the technology is going to advance to.
Are you doing work with fauna as well?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
What are you doing?
Just, well, you mean flora?
Flora, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, we are also in, not only in we have a frozen garden that we work with as well, so that we're, you know, there's been actually agriculturally a number of seed banks that are preserving our food crops around the world. And what we're doing is if there's endangered plants, then, you know, we try to freeze those as well.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Dr. Betty Dresser, so here's how you reach us. This work is just amazing, isn't it? Some of you, I hope, had a chance to see what she's doing on the CBS program a couple weeks ago, I believe it was, 60 Minutes. She was featured, along with our guest last week, who was talking about woolly mammoths. I want to ask her more about using DNA from hair and not live cells, if we will see scientific progress in that area. She is a remarkable woman. She's the Senior Vice President of Research and Facility Director for the Audubon Center for Research of Endangered Species, which is located just outside of New Orleans. And she's been doing all kinds of work. The center opened in 1996. She's been trying to preserve seriously endangered species by developing new reproductive technologies and reintroduction techniques that are necessary to ensure their long-term survival. She's also working with plants, as you heard her say. We wonder if you would like to join us, because you can. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655 for Dr. Betsy Dresser. And our email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Dr. Betsy Dresser, our guest. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We welcome your phone calls for Dr. Betsy Dresser. Our number is 800-486-8655. And the email address, if you'd like to send an email, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Dr. Dresser, how much space does it take to put all of this live DNA in the liquid nitrogen? Is it a huge space or not that big?
No, actually, it doesn't take much space at all, because if you look at what might be the end of a little soda straw, actually, is how we preserve these cells. We can put one or numbers of them in these little straws, and then they're held in these liquid nitrogen tanks. And so it depends on how much you have. What we have here in New Orleans, because of the threat of the hurricanes, we have these small canisters that are about the size of milk cans, old milk cans, if you think of it that way. Mm-hmm. And those, each can will hold probably 5,000 individuals at least. And we have about 25 of these, because we can evacuate them if a hurricane threatens us, as we did in Katrina. And so, you know, we've got tens of thousands of animals in these
tanks. Oh, my goodness, do you really?
Yeah, and I mean, it may take the space of, you know, a small room, really. And then the freezers that we use are also in this room. But it doesn't take a lot of space. So it's an incredibly important, I think the potential of freezing is just a very powerful tool.
Tens of thousands of animals.
Yes.
Woo. Let's go to phone calls. Peggy is next from Tigerton. Hi, Peggy.
Hi. Thank you for this wonderful program. It's fascinating. I have a question for you, Betsy.
Sure.
Let's say we have an endangered antelope, as you were mentioning, and you find a surrogate, and you come up with a live birth. Who's going to teach this individual animal how to be what it really is and not something else? You get what I'm saying? Animals
yeah.
are more than DNA. They make sounds to each other. They they have a family. I mean, it makes them more than just DNA. How will these animals adjust
That's
to
a
not
good
have
question.
Parents to teach them? Or
great question, Peggy. I have to tell you, we have done this, and you know, it seems like the behaviors, most of the behaviors at least, are instinctually almost ingrained in the DNA of these animals. We've had antelope born to another species of antelope, and they grow up being themselves. And what we've done is as soon as they're ready to be weaned, or if by chance they're hand-raised, we put them in with the herd of their like kind. And I have to tell you, we've had these animals go on and then reproduce naturally. And so it almost seems like it's so hardwired in the DNA that it doesn't seem to make a difference. And we've done it with cats
family.
As well.
Oh, sorry.
I was just going to say, we've done it with cats as well.
Uh-huh.
And you know, a domestic cat will raise these little wild cats, and as soon as they're old enough to act wild, boy, they do.
I noticed the elephants that have family structure and have older ones teaching younger ones, those raised not in their family situation, some of those adolescents have gone pretty crazy not knowing how to behave. That's kind of the thought I had, was that, you know, the adolescent elephants that actually
sure.
are culling rhinoceroses?
Yeah. Yeah. I think, at least with what we're doing, we try to put them back with their own species. Again, you know, using this technology is kind of, I don't want to say last resort, but it's a resort that you fall to if you don't have another choice.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for the call. And I want to get back, because we were talking about woolly mammoths last week. I'm wondering about, you were talking about live DNA and dead DNA. Our guest was talking about getting DNA samples from hair, thinking that woolly mammoths might be able to be resurrected at some point. Will the science take us there, do you think, that you'll be able to do some of this work with dead DNA? Then we're thinking about bringing back dinosaurs?
You know, again, I'm going to answer you that theoretically, I think it may be possible. We feel, at least we believe here in our organization, that we needed to try to preserve what's alive right now instead of trying to bring things back, because there's so many things that we're losing. We want to try to keep up with what's going extinct now. So we're probably not going to work in that area, but theoretically, I suspect that, you know, there's some good science out there. It might be possible.
Ilsa is next from Chicago. Hi, Ilsa.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Great. First of all, I just wanted to say thank you so much for what you're doing. We may all appreciate it a lot more later on. and my question is, if you have a limited number of samples from species, do you anticipate there being any issues down the line if, for example, an individual animal had a genetic flaw?
Yeah, I suppose that's possible. You know, again, let me emphasize, we're trying to keep the DNA so that we have a template and at least know what these individual animals were, you know, in the beginning, if you will. I suspect in the future, with all of the transgenics or, you know, the genetic engineering of moving genes around, much that's being done in science today, I suspect that it might be possible to take whatever those flawed genes are and over either what we call knock them out or you know, just not just remove them essentially, and so. I don't know. I can only predict that there will be that kind of, you know, possibility in the future.
Very much. Is there a way that listeners today can contribute to your cause?
You are a wonderful person to ask. Thank you. Yes. It's AudubonInstitute.com.
AudubonInstitute.com.
And if you go there and you click on conservation, you'll see what we're doing, as well as there's a way to donate to our program. And we thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. How are you getting the DNA samples? Do you have people doing this in the field or from zoos? They're not all coming to you, are they?
All coming, you mean the samples?
No, the animals aren't coming to you so you can get the sample and then they go back to wherever they came from.
No. Many zoos and aquariums send us samples, both primarily from collections that are in the United States, and you know, for years you couldn't import a lot of living cells because of disease potential, you know, coming into our livestock industry. And things are changing a little bit with improved methods. But one of the greatest things about what we know now, moving towards cloning, and I'm not saying actually doing the cloning in every case, but we can take a skin sample now, and it's very, very easy. That you get your hands on an animal and you take a small little tissue biopsy, and that's what we use. We can grow these cells in tissue culture and get thousands of them, and that's what we end up freezing.
Aren't you still astounded by this, or is it commonplace to you at this point?
No, I tell you, Kathleen, I'm in awe of it all the time. As we do this work and you see, you know, the end product when you have babies born or when you see things in the lab, you know, the petri dishes where you see the development of these little embryos that you know you're going to, you know, be able to save. I'm in constant awe of it. You know, it's just unbelievable.
It really is. Let's go to Ken from Watertown. Hi, Ken.
Hello.
Hello.
I received a letter from the president of Northwestern Mutual Life Insurance in 1975 that was. And he's included and also a report, a genetic engineering report for the life insurance industry. And in there it said that they were concerned really that women will no longer have to bear children. It'll all be done in a laboratory through an artificial womb. Is that going to be maybe possible with animals?
That's a good question, Ken. I think it will be possible through these artificial wombs, and that would be a great help with this. Again, let me emphasize, this is not something that I hope we do commonly. It's just kind of a last resort safety net kind of approach, and I think you're right.
And Northwestern Mutual sent a letter on this, Ken?
Pardon?
How did you find it? I'm trying to figure out what the life insurance company, why they sent you the letter.
I challenged the president at the time because he was quite a civic leader in that period. And I said, when are you going to start talking about genetic engineering? And he sent me this rather report. Plus his personal letter, and of course I've got them. I got the proof of what I just told
sure.
you.
So no, I believe you.
Pardon?
I believe you.
Oh, okay then.
All right, Ken. Yeah. Thank you. Thanks very much for the call. Bob is next from Eau Claire. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. Betsy, I have two words, first of all, to say to you. Who dat?
Who dat? You're right.
That was a heck of a game.
Thanks, Bob.
The current issue of Mental Floss magazine has got a feature article about smugglers, people who smuggle endangered animals. Now, it's mostly butterflies and small animals, but it's not exclusively that. And these animals are endangered to the extreme. One, excuse me, and one particular species was down to 130 individuals.
Mm.
And these people are smuggling these animals to feed the greedy machinations, for lack of a better word, of collectors, people who want to have the ultimate collection. And they talked about this one super individual smuggler who was finally caught after years. It took them years, and they knew he was doing it. They were watching him doing it. It took them years to finally collect enough evidence to convict him of this crime. He got less than 2 years, 21 months.
Mm.
And he has since been released, and for all we know, he's back doing it again. And so I see this as almost an idiotic dance between what you're trying to accomplish in your facility and others like you, on one hand, and then on the other hand, we've got these other individuals who seem to be going out of their way to completely destroy the habitat and hasten the disappearance of these animals. How do you, first of all, obviously some laws need to be changed, although with the gridlock in Washington, good luck with that. But how do you keep working in the face and the knowledge that there are these other people who are working to defeat whatever it is you're trying to accomplish?
It's a terrible, terrible problem. And I can only say to you that I believe we have to do something to counter those kinds of things. And, we work day to day trying to preserve the wildlife that we have, and we realize all of these things go on, and we try to work with our professional organizations and lobby the lawmakers and work with other zoos and aquariums. And I too, like you, can only hope that we can put a stop to this at some point. It's not what we do best here at our organization, so we're just trying to do what we do best to counter most of that.
You wonder where people's thoughts are at times, don't you? Obviously, they're not thinking, but it's just amazing. Thank you very much, Bob, for your call. Our number, we have some lines open now if you'd like to join the conversation. Dr. Betsy Dresser is our guest, Senior Vice President of Research and Facility Director for the Audubon Center for Research of Endangered Species, located just outside New Orleans. 800-486-8655. The email again, talk@wpr.org. Paul is next from West Bend. Hi, Paul.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi, Paul.
Dr. Dresser. I had a question for you. Starting back in the mid-80s, I had my biology students involved in a blood protein electrophoresis project analyzing the blood proteins from animals from the Milwaukee County Zoo. And I know some of the initial data was incorporated into the species survival plans.
Mm-hmm.
Since you mentioned a lot of your samples came from zoos, I wonder if any of that data is also might be incorporated into the research that you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, any data that we can get, in particular if it came through the Milwaukee County Zoo, any of that is you know, very helpful to us. And we do work with them, as well as the International Crane Foundation up there in Baraboo.
Excellent.
Yeah, so, hey, thank you for doing that. That's great.
Oh, it was a great project for the students. They really got some firsthand experience in doing some research and feeling that they were making some contributions then.
Mm-hmm. Good. I hope you've, you know, brainwashed them into conservation.
Oh, we worked at it real hard.
That's great, because, boy, it's the younger generation that we need to influence to, you know, to follow in our footsteps.
Thank you so much for the call.
Thank you.
At what point, Dr. Dresser, do you realize that you need to take some kind of action, that the species numbers are so low that you need to do interspecies birth or test tube or something of that nature?
Well, what we try to do is promote, or particularly through our scientific publications, we try to at least put out there that, you know, we've been able to develop the technology that may help a certain species of antelope or a certain species of cats. And it seems like most people that are involved with wildlife will, at least through the government organizations or universities or whatever, they'll be a little bit aware of what we're doing, and then they'll call us and say, you know, hey, can you help us with this? Can you help us with that? For example, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service called us about a species of crane, the Mississippi sandhill crane, that were found only in Mississippi, and they were dropping down to around 40 birds. And they asked us, because they knew we had been involved with artificial insemination and freezing semen, and they asked us if we would take some of these birds and work with them so that we could then release chicks back into the wild. And we've been doing this now for about 12, 13 years.
Huh.
And so, you know, that's just one example, working with partners who become, you know, aware that a certain species has dropped so low in number, and we need to do something now and use the technologies we've developed.
Thank you, Paul, so much for your call. Sarah from Sparta, hi.
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 I thank you for taking my call, and I appreciate the conversation. I kind of came into this a little late, so just trying to follow along and catch up. But one comment that caught me was when the lady called and asked about behavioral traits being caught, you know, how would an animal trait become its own species in absence of mentoring animals. And it's interesting that you're talking about cranes, because my understanding is that that's precisely the problem with fostering whooping cranes with sandhill cranes. When they are fostered with sandhills, they don't adopt the behaviors of either the sandhills or their own species, and because of that, they're unable to mate. It was just an observation, and I thought it was an intriguing question, and I just wondered if you had any comment on that. Am I incorrect in my understanding on that?
No, you're very correct, and when I was responding to the woman the call before, I was talking about mammals. Birds are kind of a whole different story, as you probably know, because they imprint so easily. And so we have to be very careful that we keep that species, whichever it is that we're trying to reproduce, that they do have model animals of which to imprint on. And, you know, something else you might find interesting, we've been involved in this, what they call Operation Migration, you know, where they're flying whooping cranes behind these ultralights. And we've found that even before they hatch, the chicks have got to hear the sounds of the engines of that ultralight when they're in the egg, so that when they hatch, they imprint on the ultralights, and then they follow them, you know, on a migratory path down to Florida, from Wisconsin to Florida. And so, you know, there's a lot we're learning about birds that are different than mammals. And so your comments are appreciated, because that's very true, what you just said.
Aren't birds amazing that they can do that? That imprinting process, it's quite miraculous.
Oh, it is. Birds are kind of a different ballgame.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Sarah. But then again, everything's kind of a different ballgame, right?
I know. Everything we're faced with. You know,
right.
There's nothing to sometimes compare it to, you know, so you have to kind of trial and error it.
Right. Billy from Green Bay. Hi.
Hi. I was just curious about how you guys plan to deal with the lack of genetic diversity as a species you're trying to help, like the number of individuals decline. Are you guys taking samples from multiple individuals? Or what are you doing to counter that?
Yes, we are. And we're trying to keep the genetic pool as large as we can, realizing that, you know, in numbers of different species of animals, you know, the oryx is a prime case. The scimitar horned oryx, you know, they got down to 12 individuals. And and yet, you know, science was able to reproduce them and bring them back, and they're doing fine. It seems like there's numbers of species of animals that even though they do seem to us to be so genetically small as a population, they can recover. So we're trying to manage them as well as we can, you know, with the genetic material that we have. But, you know, if you have to choose extinction versus a small genetic pool, we're going to choose that and then try to breed these animals up so that we can then, you know, diversify them more.
All right. And do you think, like, in the future, you'll be able to use things like future technologies and our increased understanding of transgenics to, like, create a larger genetic pool?
Yeah, that's a great comment because I think, again, theoretically, I think that's probably where a lot of the transgenic work is headed.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Uh-huh.
And when you think about the time that we're no longer here, 100 years from now or 200 years from now, do you have any idea of where your field is going to be, Dr. Dresser?
Well, again, like in this book I'm writing, there's a thread of technology advancement, you know, and I just have a feeling that we may be on other planets. I have a feeling that we're going to be able to take this technology and manipulate it a lot more. I think hopefully the human species is going to wake up and realize that we don't want to be alone on this planet, and we do care that it's, you know, populated with other wildlife and wild plants and just the beautiful forests that we have. And so I think there's going to be a real rethinking of how greedy we are as a species and how dominant.
Thanks,
my thoughts.
Yeah. Thanks, Billy, for your call. Ken from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Good morning. Dr. Dresser, thank you for your work of hope.
Sure. Thanks, Ken.
For humanity. I've got a couple points. One, there's a professor at University of Montana, and his name escapes me, but he put out a DVD, Jewels of the Jungle, where he's exploring prehistoric saprophytes in South America for their antibiotic characteristics. Granted, we know the numbers are disappearing on some of the mammalian and other species, but how about ones we just don't know enough about to know even if there is another specific saprophyte? And another question I have is involving collaboration. Are you working with Vetner, the individual who did the Human Genome Project? Just a couple points there. I was just wondering if you could help me with. I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah, to answer you, no, we have not worked with the Human Genome Project because, again, we have so limited time and resources that, you know, we work only with the animals right now. And what was the first part? I'm sorry.
Oh, the first part was... are you working with, you know, he brought up a name, didn't he? Oh, that
well,
was the
scientist.
Human.
Yes. Yeah. No, I was not aware that he was doing that, the Jewels of the Jungle. So I will look that up.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for the call. Are these figures out of date, or I in reading about you, maybe you said this, and maybe it's even worse now, 24% of all mammals, 12% of all birds, and 14% of all plants already face extinction?
Yes.
Whew.
I know. It's scary, isn't it?
What have we done?
Oh, we've overpopulated this planet. There's too many of us, in my opinion.
There must be way too many of us. Those are extraordinary figures, Dr. Dresser.
Well, we're so dominant, you know. I mean, we just tear down forests, and you know, we want the best of everything, and sometimes we don't always think about the other... life that shares this planet. And so I think we're just going to have to do something about that. And I'm not quite sure what the answer to it all is.
We welcome more phone calls. Our guest this hour is the director of the Audubon Center for Research of Endangered Species and the Audubon Species Survival Center. It's located outside of New Orleans. Dr. Betty Dresser, Senior Vice President of Research and Director for the center. They are doing some remarkable work through, you know, it sounds like space age science to me still, but it's being done and on a fairly large scale here. Very innovative scientific programs accelerating reproduction to preserve the Earth's genetic heritage. Here's our phone number. Join us in our last few minutes here. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Or if you'd like to send an email, that would be fine. talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. And Ron is going to post a little more information on our Facebook page as well, so you know how to get a hold of Dr. Dresser. Our page is just, well, you know, you go to Facebook and then you go to the Kathleen Dunn Show and you can sign up or get the information that you need. So call us. We have a couple minutes left here and time for more of your informed calls. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dr. Betsy Dresser, our guest, our phone number 800-486-8655. A couple lines are open if you'd like to join us. Bill from Madison is our next caller. Hi, Bill.
Yes. The cheetahs, you know, they can take transplants for each to each. They're so genetically pure. What about the oryx? Has anybody ever thought of trying to do some transplant of tissue to see how genetically pure they are? Because you said there were only 12 left and now there's more of them. It'd be interesting to find out.
Yeah, that's a very good point. No, I don't know of anyone that has done that specifically. You know, again, it costs to do all this kind of work, and so I don't think that's been done yet.
And how do we determine how many of a certain species are left? How do people spot them?
Well, different organizations will do censuses on different wildlife, depending on what countries they're working in. And there's something called the Red Data Book that's put out over in Europe, and it tries to keep up with at least a census that's done every couple years, actually, on particular species. And we refer to that quite often.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the staff you have working with you, their range of specialties, Dr. Dresser.
Yeah, it takes a whole special staff, believe me, to do what we're doing, and it ranges from everything from we have animal keepers that that take care of animal managers that take care of the animals and supervisors. And then we have a whole scientific staff, everything from veterinarians to senior scientists to lab technicians and research assistants. And then we have an intern program here, as well as we take graduate students and postdoctoral students. So it takes a whole staff to do the kind of thing that we're doing.
Yeah, I'm sure it must.
And also a brain trust. We use a lot of consultants that actually more or less volunteer for us, as well as human docs who come in and when we have a particular problem, they'll volunteer for us, and you know, we'll just throw ideas around and try to come up with maybe an attack on something that we're trying to do.
There were a couple stories that I wanted you to tell us about. One was, I can't remember where I read this, about the fluorescent cat that was born.
Oh, yes. We had what we call a glow-in-the-dark cat. It was a domestic cat clone, and the reason it glowed is because it was a transgenic cat. We inserted some genetic material from proteins that produce green fluorescent protein. And the reason we did it is because we needed a marker to be able to show that indeed we transferred that gene, and it caused the cat's skin to glow green. Actually, we had him on the Today Show, and it was around Halloween. I'm sure that was what the interest was. But the real reason we did it was to show that we could actually do it. And now that we know we can, what we're trying to do is insert genes that override diseases in cats to try to be able to help some of these endangered cats survive.
So have you done that already?
We're working on it right now.
How close are you to being able to do that pretty fully?
Oh, pretty close.
Are you really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, again, it's just another tool to be able to use to try to save some of these endangered cats, because we just had a little cat, smallest cat in the cat family, just a beautiful little cat called a rusty spotted cat from Sri Lanka. And there were only 17 of them in captivity. And so we've been able to work with them, and now we have all of their material. And through embryo transfer and using a domestic cat as a surrogate, we're trying to produce some of these little rusty spotted cats. So anyway, it's just one example of how you use these tools.
Right. And how difficult is that to do that gene transfer to make the animals healthier? Is that very, very tricky? Or?
Well, it's not tricky as much as it takes expertise and practice in the laboratory. And some of our senior scientists here are very capable of doing that. And so it really just takes practice and development to pull it off.
Mm-hmm. And those rusty spotted cats, where are they now? Or where is that gorilla now, that in vitro? No, the test tube gorilla.
Yeah. Actually, the test tube gorilla is out at the zoo in Omaha, Nebraska.
Oh.
You know, and has had babies as well. So.
Huh. And the other animals, where do they go? To zoos?
Yeah, they're at different zoos. You know, and two, after Hurricane Katrina hit here, we had to send out a bunch of our animals because we lost so much fencing. And we didn't lose any of the animals, which was great, but all the zoos and aquariums came in to help us and you know, move animals out of here. So some of the animals we have not brought back just because we've moved on to other projects.
Well, that must have been a horrendous time for you.
Oh, it was unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
But it's great because the other zoos that have these animals, then they can promote some of the science, and it helps us with our funding as well.
Mm-hmm. And how does somebody become a person like you, Dr. Dresser? What did you study? Because some of this is just brand new to the world. How do you prepare yourself for things that are brand new?
Well, universities, particularly vet schools and schools that have animal science programs, you know, they teach you a lot of the advanced technology that's available today, you know, as time comes forth. And I mean, when I first got involved in this, there was not a lot of that, but working with domestic animals, cattle, sheep, horses, and pigs, you know, we learned ways to do science that we could then apply to the wildlife. And, you know, it just takes zoos that want to be able to get involved in this kind of work to be able to put the money into it, really.
And it takes a lot of coordination. You need money from a lot of places on a worldwide basis, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And plus it takes, you know, we bring a lot of students in here, and that's really good because it's new thinking, new energy.
Right.
And so, you know, we try to train students to be able to, not only here in the United States, but from areas where these animals originate so that they can take this technology back to those countries and try to help preserve the animals where they are.
Well, you're the kind of person you could never dream what it is you're doing for your living right now because it didn't exist when you were a little kid, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I just knew I wanted to save wildlife.
Oh, and look at you.
Yeah, God made me a steward.
Yeah. Niles is next from Ontario. Hi, Niles.
Hi. Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Betsy.
Hi.
I work down in Gulf Shores, Alabama after Hurricane Ivan.
Oh.
And the little zoo that could was featured on the Animal Planet. I'm wondering if you had anything to do with helping them out regain what they did.
Not specific. Are you talking about the zoo in Pensacola or the one in?
In Gulf Shores.
Oh, in Gulf Shores.
Yeah.
Yes, we all kind of helped each other, you know, moving animals around, and they sent staff over to help us. We sent staff over to help them. I mean, it was a great collaborative effort. You would have been impressed.
Yeah, well, I was down there. I'm a roofer, so I went down for Ivan and stayed through Rita.
Oh, my gosh.
Went down for 6 months and stayed for 3.5 years.
Oh.
And the things that they did at Gulf Shores Zoo was, Animal Planet had a story on them called The Little Zoo That Could.
Yeah, they're a great little zoo, I'll tell you.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I just wanted to thank you for working with zoos because it's a wonderful place to go with your kids and grandkids and stuff.
Well, you're very welcome. It's in my heart, I can tell you.
All right. Thank you, lady. Bye.
Bye.
Hey, go Saints.
Who dat?
You're getting a lot of that today, I'm sure.
I know, really?
Yeah. We were talking about diseases earlier. I would imagine that part of your mission is to be able to bring some of these animals back to where they originally live, if that's indeed possible. Do they face risks, or can you genetically change these genes so that they will not be putting other animals who are in the wild at risk because of the diseases that some of the animals you're working with may have come in contact with?
Yeah, I mean, that's the reason that a lot of this work is being done, Kathleen. You know, part of the problem of releasing animals that are born in captivity is because they don't have the immunity a lot of times to be put back into countries where they're threatened with certain diseases. Although a lot of our pet animals, dogs, cats, whatever, that you know, we're spreading out with are also spreading diseases that if you keep companion animals, you know, in these other countries. But I think that's part of the effort of trying to get a handle on some of this disease work is so that we could perhaps manipulate it some and then put the animals back in the wild. I think that's the real reason for it, mm-hmm. at least in zoos.
Well, you've been just fascinating. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, you're welcome, and I really appreciate your interest. Come and see us sometime.
Well, I would love to do that. I've never been to New Orleans, and I would love to see what you're doing.
Well, call me if you ever come down here.
Thank you. I will do that. Thank you so much for the invitation. Dr. Betsy Dresser, our guest. What interesting work she's doing, right? Senior Vice President of Research and Facility Director for the Audubon Center for Research of Endangered Species, located on 1,200 acres, 25 minutes from downtown New Orleans. They've been around for 20-some years and have a big staff now as they do work to give animals that have threatened futures a chance at survival through some really cutting-edge science. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Thanks for all of your calls. Lots of great conversation ahead on the Ideas Network, and we'll join you again tomorrow at 9 o'clock for interesting conversation. Thanks for listening. This is the Ideas Network.